This is XTP Media.
You know, the major components of a C-47 don't fit in a 40-foot sea container. So items such as the main sort of fuselage, if you will, and the center section were put onto special sort of cradles or jigs, if you like, and loaded onto to low-loader lorries.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And this episode, we focus on revisiting some of the restoration projects we've covered in the past. First, we talk to Charlie Walker, who's restoring the C-47 Night Fright, a wonderful project to bring what is a classic aircraft back to the skies of the UK. Then we talk to Sam Worthington-Lease, who is a trustee at the Hawker Typhoon Restoration Project, and we find out the progress they've made since we last talked a few years ago to rebuild to flight RB-396. Finally, we talk to Dave Morris, the curator at the Fleet Air Arm Museum, on the ongoing restoration of DP-872. Of course, that's the Fairey Barracuda. Dave's always a fantastic source of restoration and historical information, so I hope you'll enjoy that coverage too. Now, we also play some content we picked up at Air Day 2018 as inserts into this show. Sometimes there's great airshow commentary we don't always get to use, and some of us don't always listen to on the day. So we've recorded some of that, which we thought would be useful for you to hear in this episode. So without further ado, let's get on. First talking to Charlie Walker. Charlie, welcome back to Extended. It's been 5 years.
Thanks, Peter, and good evening. Yeah, it's been a long time. As I was saying sort of briefly, I can't believe where the time's gone, really. But lots has happened. So, plenty to keep you updated with it, and good to talk to you again.
Yeah, well, let's get on to topic as soon as we can. For those who maybe weren't following us or haven't heard the episode, can you just give us a little bit of a synopsis on Fright Night and how you came about being involved with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me take you back a bit. Let's go back to the back end of 2012. So we sort of tracked down and found a C-47 or DC-3, however you want to call it, in a scrapyard in Arkansas in the United States. The idea was to purchase an aircraft that had flown from Membry, which my father owns, which was obviously one of the five troop carrier bases. Where the guys took off for the D-Day landings, etc. So initially we thought we'd find an aircraft and just bring it back and sort of put it as a gate guardian at Membry and just sort of give a little bit back to the airfield and, you know, the area and sort of remember the guys that lost their lives fighting for our freedom. But once we tracked down the aircraft and we sort of, you know, we secured the services of the aircraft, we thought, well, it would be a bit sad, you know, if we couldn't get this aircraft flying, really. So we set about not only sort of, restoring the aircraft and getting it airworthy, but we want to sort of go into as much detail as we can, really, and get the aircraft looking, you know, as it would have done, you know, when it took off for D-Day. So, a lot of work's gone into the project, since the back end of 2012, November 2012, when we purchased it, to up to a point where we're hoping to have her ready to fly for the 75th anniversary of D-Day next year.
Wow. Now, we spoke, I think, a year or so after you'd bought the aircraft. Just again, for those who don't know, you are actually a qualified pilot. You fly biz jets at the moment. I'll come back to that in a minute. But the intention was that you were going to go over to, I think it was in Florida, wasn't it, at the time, get your type rating and fly the aircraft back, because you'd actually already started restoring the aircraft at that time. Obviously, a lot has changed since then, because the aircraft is no longer in Florida. Tell us the journey you've been on in the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's right, Peter. So when we bought the aircraft back at the end of 2012, and initially we got it going and airworthy quite quickly, sort of, you know, 4 or 5 day period, we just sort of rescued it, sort of pulled it out of the weeds, if you like, and we ferried it to a little place called Punta Gorda in Florida, where a father and son team of Glenn and Frank Moss set about restoring the aircraft. Both DC-3 pilots and operators. Frank's somewhat of a legendary DC-3 pilot over in the US. So those guys set about restoring the aircraft for us, and we sort of slowly sort of carried on with the project, really. But for various reasons, we decided to move the project to the UK. The main one being, really, is that it was difficult for us to keep jumping on a plane over to the US, yeah, you know, to look at the project and sort of chase progress and make decisions. So we wanted it on our doorstep, really. So that was sort of the main driver behind the decision. But you're absolutely right. I'd been over to Florida numerous times, and on those visits I've completed my DC-3 type rating, so I had sort of limited tailwheel experience, really. I've got plenty of light aircraft experience and biz jet experience now, but I needed to sort of cut my teeth on a small tailwheel aircraft to start with. So I did a bit of basic training. I flew a Piper Cub for a little bit, and then did some training on a Warbird trainer that they would have used back in the day, a BT-13, which was great fun. And then slowly stepped up to the DC-3. But it was an intense sort of 3 or 4 week period, really, very enjoyable, but sort of very intense, you know, coming in with limited tailwheel experience. There was a lot to do. I had to convert all of my UK licenses over to the American FAA system. So I had to do all the theory for the PPL and the CPL and the instrument rating, as well as the practical tests and the sort of the tailwheel experience, culminating with the DC-3 flight test, which was an intense 3-hour test in the hot Florida sunshine. But great fun.
At the time we spoke, the aircraft was airworthy. It required a lot of work, but it was airworthy. Did you get the chance to fly it before she was disassembled and brought back to the UK?
Do you know what? I didn't. And the point you make is somewhat ironic, and that fact is not lost on me, that we've taken an airworthy aircraft out of a scrapyard and disassembled it into sort of kit form. But no, sadly, I didn't get a chance, and I haven't had a chance to fly the aircraft yet. I've flown a number of other C-47s, both in the UK and Europe and over in the US, but it was sort of somewhat rushed, really. I mean, we literally saved the aircraft. It was in a scrapyard about to be cut up for parts, so we just needed a get her going and get her out there to Florida. And then obviously, as part of the restoration progress, what we've done is disassembled it from then on. But you know, we're seeing tremendous progress in the UK now in terms of the aircraft sort of being built back up, and you know, I'm sort of counting down the days until I get the opportunity to fly her.
So Charlie, tell us about the project to bring her over. I watched it with interest on social media, and you've got a great presence there, so we'll share that in a little while. Every single part of that aircraft was taken apart. In chunks, it was shipped over. Literally, it came over on a ship, didn't it? Where's it gone since arriving in the UK in its various bits?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a massive project, both logistically and financially, to move the aircraft from the US back to the UK. But luckily, we're in logistics, so we've got a little bit of experience in that field, albeit probably not moving C-47s across the Atlantic. But it was an experience, that's for sure. So the way it worked is we had a team of experts on the ground in Florida for 4 weeks, led by a chap called Clive Edwards, who's a very, very experienced DC-3 engineer and pilot. So he led a team of 3 or 4 who were on the ground in Florida for 4 weeks, systematically disassembling the aircraft aircraft and packing most of the parts into boxes and into containers and labeling them, you know, in terms of how they came apart, where they came from, so we know what we had in terms of an inventory when we got back to the UK. But obviously, you know, the major components of a C-47 don't fit in a 40-foot sea container. So items such as the main sort of fuselage, if you will, and the center section were put onto special sort of cradles or jigs, if you like, and loaded onto to low loader lorries. And then they go on what's called a roll-on, roll-off cargo. So you literally drive them onto the boat, sort of park them up on the boat, and 3 weeks after you drive them off at the other end. So that was probably 4 weeks disassembling it, and then 3 weeks probably on the water. So sort of 7 weeks later, it arrived in Southampton in the UK, sort of beginning of last year. And then we hauled it by road with an escort up to Coventry at what used to be Air Atlantique. And the project's now being led by Ben Cox of Air Atlantique Restorations.
Right. Okay. So at the moment, as we've seen just this very week, there are parts that are very recognisable as that C-47, but they're not quite all together. What stage are you at the moment in terms of the airframe restoration? What's going on?
Yeah, the aircraft is pretty much as it arrived, if you will, Peter. So it's in its major sections. So the fuselage is still sat on its cradle, sort of, you know, in a flat position, horizontal. The center section is sort of stood up on one end. So those are the major two sections, if you like. So they're each being worked on individually. The fuselage has obviously been sort of paint stripped inside and out, and you know, all of the cockpit's been gutted. And then we've sort of been gradually going through it and doing any structural repairs inside and out that are required. We've replaced the upper and lower channels around the cargo door as an example, and separately the center sections being worked on as well. Really, there's a massive amount of metal corrosion in the center section, something that's quite common to DC-3s. That's where the fuel tanks are contained in the center section. So probably you know, thousands and thousands of man hours have gone into those structural repairs. So we've been doing that and sort of ripping all the pipe work and cabling out and sort of gradually sort of going through those, replacing them, painting them. So the idea is to sort of bring those two sections together probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks. So you will then sort of mate the fuselage and center section together, if you will, and then the landing gear will go back in and it'll sit back on its wheels as an aircraft, which will be an exciting day for us, given that it's been sort of a part in kit form for years. But you know, besides that, there's lots going on around the outside. There's all sorts of little bits being worked on. We've got two brand new overhauled engines come over from the US. They're on stands in the hangar with the sort of the accessories being built up around them on the frames. The landing gear and brakes are all being overhauled and built up separately. Just endless amounts of work.
Charlie, sorry to interrupt you there. You just mentioned the engines. I think when we talked all those many years ago, a colleague of mine who was presenting was asking me about the engines. What engines have you got for it? What's the spec and the power plant that you're going to put onto a?
Yeah, so we've got two engines which have come over from the US. We had sort of three cores, if you like, when we bought the aircraft, and obviously we needed to overhaul those. So we sent two away straight away whilst the project was still in the US to be overhauled, two Pratt & Whitney 1830-92s. So they were done pretty quickly. So ironically, we've had those sort of zero timed and ready to go for quite some time, even though we haven't had an aircraft to hang them on. So they've been ready a little while. It's just the accessories and the bits and pieces around the edge that we need to sort of pull together now, you know, before we can hang them on the aircraft. But we've just made the decision as well to send a third one over for overhaul, so that's in the States at the moment, and that'll probably be ready towards the back end of the year, and then we'll get that shipped over. It's obviously a big year for the aircraft next year. We've got the 75th anniversary of D-Day for a week, then the 70th anniversary of the Berlin airlift, and then Market Garden towards the back end of the year as well. And you know, we just want to have that spare engine in case we've got any niggles, because with over 40 C-47s, you know, at those events, sort of few parts are going to be few and far between if you need them, really.
Yeah, they very much will be. So is the plan then to have a airworthy before the 75th anniversary?
Yeah, it's going to be very tight. We're up against it anyway. But yeah, absolutely right. We do need her to be ready a little bit before that event, because we need to do some shakedown flying and yeah. some testing. And, you know, I'm sure some bits and pieces will need to be tweaked and adjusted. So, yeah, if we can have her ready, you know, a few weeks, you know, months before June next year, that would be fantastic. But it's a big project and, you know, and there's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Couple of questions then, Charlie, about the restoration itself. You talked about some of the corrosion, some of the metals. I fully understand, and I suppose it's understandable that an aircraft of that age would have that. How does one go about making the decisions as to what you're going to keep as original, genuine aircraft pieces and the bits that you have to restore? Do you literally have to make those decisions as they come up?
Yeah, you do, really. It's you know, as I always try to explain to people, it's a bit of a balance, really. I mean, you know, our ideal is obviously to make it as original as possible, but you know, it's a balance between, you know, being able to do that and, you know, where there's more modern, sort of more efficient, you know, reliable parts available, then sometimes you'd be foolish not to utilize those parts. And obviously there's certain modern regulations that you have to comply with anyway, so there's certain parts that you can't use. But the beauty of disassembling the aircraft to the extent we did in the US and bringing it over to the UK is we've perhaps found things that we wouldn't have done if we just assembled it sort of to a slightly less, if you will. So we've taken it as far apart as it probably would ever go. So I'd like to think that we've pretty much found and corrected everything where we possibly can.
Right. Okay. Tell me then about the cockpit. How are you going to restore that? What do you do in terms of the specification for that? Because obviously some equipment will be genuine, but given the day and age we're in, you're going to need some additional technology, I would have thought, in there. What's the plan for the cockpit?
The plan for the cockpit, again, is to be as original as we possibly and practically can. So we've got a couple of guys who are particularly expert in this area. So they've been through all the original parts manuals. And for example, we're obviously going to, you know, make an original instrument panel. So we're going to cut it with all the original holes for all the original dials and gauges, etc. And we've actually managed to already find a substantial amount of genuine instruments to go in that instrument panel. And we certainly won't give up looking for the ones that we're missing. But of course, you're absolutely right. There's going to be an element of modern equipment that's going to be required to be in the cockpit. So we will obviously have what's required, but we'll try our best to sort of tuck those bits of modern equipment, screens and boxes, away in little corners, or perhaps even be a little bit creative and cut the tops off some old instruments and maybe hide them underneath, that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay. So coming back to the aircraft and its residence, it's being reassembled in Coventry. Is the plan still to bring it back to Membury?
Yeah, absolutely. That's still the long-term plan. That's on our agenda. Obviously, priority number one is to get this aircraft finished and flying, particularly with what's happening next year. But Membury, very much still on the agenda. We're still looking to do that and give something back to the airfield and to the local area. So I'm not sure if we discussed this when we spoke all that time ago, but we're in the process of opening a little museum at Membury as well. So we're recreating a World War II Nissan-style hut, and that will be the basis of our museum at Membury. So we've got lots of sort of local experts and historians who are going to sort of donate items to the museum, and then it's just going to be a free you know, to view museum to the public. So that'll be nice. And the long-term plan is still to hangar the aircraft at Membury. We're slightly limited in terms of the runway length that we've got at Membury, unless we extend what we've got still, which is on the agenda, but that's a big project. So it might be initially that we do something like base the aircraft at Membury during the summer and keep it on the hard standing at Coventry in the winter, because the bulk of memories is grass and it gets quite wet over the winter months.
Right. And will she need, I mean, she's obviously going to be fully restored. She'll be in fantastic condition, but you'll want to maintain her that way. Will she need to be hangared at all, or will she live outside?
No, she'll certainly live indoors. Yeah, it's always better if these aircraft are hangared where possible. I mean, there are some that live outside, but you got to be quite careful. You got to make sure all the gust locks are in at all times, and you know, you want to be regularly moving them if there's strong gusts of wind predicted, for example. Yeah. So ours will definitely be hangared. We're not going to go to the trouble of restoring her to the extent we are and then leave her outside. I don't think.
Now, a big driving force other than your energy and passion is your father. Is he still committed to this?
Yeah, absolutely. He's as passionate as he always is. He's still got the same passion for the aircraft and for the airfield and for the business. He's still involved in the family business. So he's still very much aware of what's going on. He probably comes up to Coventry with me every other week to keep track on, you know, both the financial side of the project and the sort of the physical aspect of the project. So, yeah, he's as eager for it to be completed as I am.
Okay. Charlie, a couple of personal questions coming away from the aircraft. Since we spoke, you've become a dad. You're about to become a dad again, so you've got three babies to look after now. But we talked about your flying career before. You were flying, I think, when we last spoke, the 125 out of Oxford. Now, I know you have had a little injury, so you've been out of the system for a while, but what's the plans for your flying career?
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to your first question, yeah, that shows how time flies. I've got a little boy, he's 2.5 now, and another one on the way in a couple of months. So time certainly does fly. But yeah, I'm still flying the HS125 and still out of Oxford. To cut a very long story short, I've worked for several different companies away from Oxford since we spoke last. But ironically, I've ended up back at Oxford flying the same 125 when we spoke last. So I'm working for a company called Gamma Aviation PLC, and I'm operating that HS125 for a private individual. So we're probably flying about 200 to 250 hours a year, which is very nice, mainly in Europe. So yeah, my long-term plan is to keep doing what I'm doing in the family business and sort of tie that in with the corporate flying, which I absolutely love, and then try to make time for the family and the project as well. But as you rightly point out, I haven't actually flown an aeroplane since the 25th of March, as I managed to rupture my Achilles tendon playing football, which has put me out of action for nearly 5 months.
Yeah. And medically, have you signed off back to fly now?
I certainly am. Yep, I've been in the simulator and done my recurrent training, and I've got my class one medical back. So my first flight is on Tuesday, which will be great.
Right. Okay. Where is that? Just a familiarization flight, or is that where are you off to? Anywhere exciting?
No, that's straight back into the saddle. So we've got the aircraft down in the south of France. So we'll be positioning out to the south of France and then bringing the aircraft back to Oxford.
Right. Okay. Exciting times. Charlie, anything else about the restoration we want to highlight to our listeners before we go? Can they get involved? Can they support it in any way?
We haven't got anything set up at the moment. We have got trying to sort of generate a little bit of social media presence. So our Facebook page is Membury Airfield Memorial Flight. I'm posting regular updates on there, as well as Instagram and Twitter, which is NightFright521. One pretty cool thing we are about to launch is got an e-commerce shop going up on the website hopefully next week. Got lots of cool stuff going on there if you want your Night Fright restoration memorabilia. But I mean, time is ticking away and we've only got a few months left to get a finish, really. So I'll be posting some pretty exciting footage over the next few weeks, months. Progress is happening pretty quickly now, so yeah, stay tuned, really.
Charlie, it's an amazing project that you, your family and the family business have taken on. I daren't even ask the scale or the enormity of the project you've taken on, but it's fantastic. So we'll stay in touch. We got our fingers crossed that you'll be flying on that 75th D-Day flight, if not before.
Thanks very much, Peter. Good to talk to you again, and let's keep in touch and I'll keep you posted.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
This one, which he put into the RAF colours that we see here, soon became the last airworthy sycamore in the world. Some years later, Peter Schmidt's technician Dieter Haserbrink wrote to Siegfried Schwarz, otherwise known as Blackie, the chief helicopter pilot of the Flying Bulls, the superb collection of Red Bull-supported historic aircraft at Salzburg in Austria, saying the Sycamore was available and inquiring about a possible sale. It was bought by the Flying Bulls and moved to their Hangar 8 maintenance facility at Salzburg in November 2010. Hangar 8, the sister building to Hangar 7, the incredible vision in steel and glass that is their main display hangar there. I'm sure many of you have seen pictures at the very least of it if you haven't been to it yourselves. With this aircraft came five other airframes, 80 rotor blades and multiple engines. Dieter Haserbrink headed up the restoration effort. The main concern was the wooden rotor blades. They have to be removed after every 10 flying hours for scanning to make sure they're in tip-top condition. It made its first flight as part of the Flying Bulls fleet in July 2013. Siegfried Schwarz had to become a certified test pilot because of the lack of Sycamore instructors and examiners, and indeed to this day he's still the only Sycamore pilot in the world. It gained its permit to fly on the Austrian register in early 2016, and it's come to Britain this year in part for the 100th anniversary celebrations of the Royal Air Force. Siegfried Schwarz told me a couple of years ago it's very difficult to fly because you have a lot of forces on the cyclic and collective controls. It's nothing like a modern helicopter. You have big trim wheels and you have to transfer fluid between the nose and the tail to keep the centre of gravity within limits. But I like it very much.
Sam, welcome back to Extended.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you back on and talking about, of course, the Hawker Typhoon. RB-396, we talked about it back in, 2015-2016. Interestingly enough, you were renovating your house at the time, I think. Lots of renovation going on. Where are we now? What's happened and what's changed?
So we're effectively 2 years further on with the project from since when we last spoke. And there have been quite a lot of developments. We've obtained a Napier Sabre, a complete and zero-houred and inhibited Napier Sabre.
How do you go about finding a zero-hour piece of equipment like that?
Yeah, it took quite a few years. It was ongoing when we spoke before, and had been for about years. Research, finding the right owners, because the people that owned it had actually effectively forgotten that they owned it, and it was on loan to someone else. So a huge paper trail. And then at the start of 2017, myself and Dave Robinson, the other trustee, took a visit to Cranfield University, who were the owners, were the head of aerospace, and they signed it over to us. They liked the project. They knew that an engine like that was key to the project. So effectively, there and then they signed it over to us. They said it's ours to use.
What's its heritage? How does a zero-hour engine like that sit around for, 70 years?
Yeah. So at the end of the war, it was obtained by Cranfield University to use effectively sort of as a training engine for engineers. As far as we know, it was never really used for that, and it was inhibited, painted with a protective paint, and they kept it sort of as a display piece for a while. Then it went to, I believe, the Science Museum in London, and then it went through a couple of other museums. You know, they all sort of loaned it to each other. And Dave Robinson did all of the legwork with the paperwork and finding out who owned it. And then Cranfield University, I say, got behind the project and signed it over to us because they knew how much we relied on an engine.
Really. Yeah. And you mentioned Dave there. Dave and yourself, of course, are the driving forces behind this. Just a little reminder for those maybe who didn't pick up our first episode on this and our first feature. Can you just give us a bit of a recap about how Dave and you got involved in restoring a Hawker Typhoon?
Yeah. So Dave Robinson moved to a house on the site of what used to be RAF Lichfield a long time ago, back in, I think, 1998, 1999. And then he sort of started to find out a bit about the history of where he was living, and that a lot of typhoons, or nearly all typhoons, went through there, which was 51 maintenance unit at RAF Lichfield. And he kind of started to question why there were no flying typhoons when there were, you know, quite a few Spitfires and Hurricanes, and why nobody really knew about the typhoon. And the more he dug, sort of the more he found out, and then he set about creating, for his own personal interest, really, a database of where various parts of typhoons survived in various museums or private collections. And then he realised that there was actually quite a bit surviving, and he made it his mission to sort of collect parts with the aim of building a cockpit replica that he could take around to shows or schools and use as a kind of educational aid. And then he got a couple of big breaks in 2012 with about 11,500 Hawker drawings that were being thrown out, 2,500 of which were Typhoon, which he purchased with his own money. And then the rear fuselage, which is the identity, RB396, also became available in 2012. And he purchased that again with his own money from a museum in Holland. And I got in contact with Dave, or rather Dave got in contact with me in about 2013 when I was researching my grandfather, who flew typhoons during the Second World War. His last flight was from RAF West Hampnett, which is now Goodwood, which is where I fly from. And I was researching his history and his last flight, and I actually found some parts of the aircraft he was flying on the day he got shot down. And Dave was after the same parts, and so our paths crossed, and we've been in touch ever since.
Wow. It is a fantastic story, and I just wanted to remind everyone of how amazing that sort of synchronicity is. So you've set up the trust, you mentioned it earlier. Since we spoke, it's gone from strength to strength, hasn't it?
It has, yes. So we established the charity in May 2016, the Hawker Typhoon Preservation Group. We had a launch event in October of 2016 at the Boltby Flight Academy at Goodwood, where we launched our supporters club, and we raffled off the first membership number one. And we've now got over 1,100 members in just over 2 years, just under 2 years, in fact. And, you know, people are joining on a daily basis. We've established a base because the supporters club provided sort of vital revenue to get, you know, to run the project on a day-to-day basis, and we needed a base to store the huge collection of parts that we've got. And we've now done that. We moved in July last year, 2017, a 2,500 foot just an industrial unit with some offices, and we hold their regular open days now, and it's our base for air shows. We've acquired a huge amount of parts since then. We've got another complete rear fuselage, a complete tail, that's from a Tempest, but very similar to the Typhoon, a Tempest rudder, a spinner, known to be, I think, the only four-blade Typhoon Tempest spinner in existence, that's the correct one, a huge section of wing spar that actually came to us at Flying Legends last year, a couple of gentlemen from Holland. A huge amount of engine spares, loads of undercarriage, a couple of wheels. We've done about 4 to 6 recoveries on the continent since we last spoke that have yielded loads of parts, mostly crash damage, but they'll be very useful for patterns. And also just providing the history of the aircraft and the pilots that were flying them when they crashed or force landed, which is part of the project as well. As well as rebuilding this aircraft, it's also about telling the story of the people that were operating them.
Yeah, that's as crucial as the aircraft itself. And of course, you've got a very personal link to that, Sam. So how does the team now go about looking at assembling all those bits and pieces into, is still the target a flyable Typhoon?
Absolutely, yeah. Everything that we're doing is being completed to airworthy standard, with the intention of flying it when it's finished. A lot could change in the time between now and then, regulation-wise. But with current regulations, we're doing everything to airworthy standard with the hope that it will fly when it's finished. We've always said from the very start that as much as we would like to rebuild this Typhoon physically ourselves, we don't have the tooling, the expertise, or the money actually to do that for what's going to be a one-off. If we were going to build five or six, then it would be different. So in the time since we last spoke, we've been to visit every major restoration facility in the country, engines and hardware, if you like, the aircraft itself. Had first-round meetings with them and second-round meetings with some of them, and we're progressing forward with a plan of attack, if you like, of how we're going to rebuild the aircraft and its sub-assemblies. The rudder is already with airframe assemblies on the Isle of Wight being rebuilt. It's actually being converted from Tempest to Typhoon. And we hope to have that back sort of towards the end of the year into the start of next year. And we started with the rudder because the one we have is fairly complete. And in the scheme of things, it's minor work compared to, say, building a wing from scratch. So the rudder is already underway. I mean, as you probably know with these things, it's quite slow progress. And when you start, you then find more problems that you didn't foresee when before you start. So it's over there, it's being rebuilt, and that's the first section. And then the next section is likely to be the tail unit itself, and then we move forward to the rear fuselage section, then the cockpit section, the tubular frame area, through to the front engine mounts. And by the time we get there, we're looking towards the wings and the engine and everything that goes with it.
And Sam, I know we talked timetable before. Is this how long's a piece of string, or is there a deadline you're targeting for? What's the estimate on when you think the airframe and the recognisable part of the airframe will come together?
So when Dave and I first started talking about this, the aim was, or still is really, the 80th anniversary of D-Day, which is in 2024. Now, 4 years ago, that gave us sort of ample time, but that's obviously creeping up on us. It's sort of six years away. We still would like to have it working and flying by then, but unfortunately now, and it's well, not unfortunately, but the fact is it now comes down to funding. We have everything we need in terms of parts and drawings. We have everyone who can do the work lined up to do it. It just comes down to hitting that big green button of funding and being able to spend £10,000-£20,000 a month on the aircraft building. That's ultimately what it comes down to, and that's what we've been concentrating on the last couple of years, is fundraising, you know, establishing that supporters club, that base of people that are keen to get behind it, attending most air shows in the country over the last 2 years. We've got Duxford coming up in a couple of weeks, expanding our merchandise, you know, accepting donations. We've registered for gift aid. That's quite vital. That allows us to claim back a little bit of extra money on top of donations. So it's all about the fundraising. And we've now got a fundraising team just getting set up to actually target or start liaising with potential larger donors and corporate sponsors to get some of the, you know, the larger amounts coming in that will allow it to move forward slightly faster.
Yeah, I think we I pressed you pretty hard last time for a figure, and I think at the time we were looking at something like 4 million as a target figure to achieve. Like all restorations, no doubt there'll be bumps along the way. Is that still the sort of ballpark figure you're working towards?
Yeah, so it's slightly more accurate now. You know, having visited all the restoration shops that do this kind of thing on a day-to-day basis, or no, not a Typhoon, you know, Sea Furies and Hurricanes have been rebuilt, and they're not dissimilar. The total budget we're now looking at to build the aircraft and the heritage centre that it will ultimately live in is 5 to 6 million. So slightly more than maybe we thought last time, but now we've got a clearer picture of what's happening and, you know, how much we need to raise. We raised, we're knocking on the door so far, since we established the charity, of about £350,000 to £400,000, and that's purely from people's donations and what are relatively small donations, you know, mostly sort of £50, £100 here and there, selling merchandise, attending air shows. We did have a big fundraising appeal to our supporters club at the back end of last year, and that actually raised £80,000 in 2 days. So,
wow,
you know, the money is coming in, and the more people we have actively supporting, the faster that amount will come in.
Yeah, and I've got to say, your merchandise is pretty cool. I know there's a lot of collectors out there who like patches, stickers, and other bits of merchandise. Yours is pretty original, pretty good. So do go over and have a look at that, see what you can do to support Sam and the team. Sam, then, the intention again was always for you to fly this aircraft. What have you been up to in terms of your flying recently? I know you've been teaching and flying, but what have you been flying and how are you preparing for the ultimate flight?
Yeah, so since I got made redundant and left the Air Force back in 2012, I've been a professional instructor. I do most of my flying from Goodwood, which used to be RAF West Hampton, both with the flying school there and a company called Ultimate High. And a lot of it is aerobatics, formation, training and experiences, and also a lot of time flying the Harvard, which I should imagine most of your listeners will know was the advanced, intermediate and advanced flying trainer for potential fighter pilots. So most pilots that flew the Typhoon would have flown the Harvard before they went to an operational conversion unit and flew something like a Hurricane and then the Typhoon. So the Harvard's an ideal trainer, and I've probably got somewhere in the region of 200 odd hours in the last couple of years on the Harvard. I'm in the process of having a career change at the moment, and what that means is I'm actually now, I've always been commercially licensed, but I'm now going to start flying with an airline in November. So that will give me slightly less seasonal work and a slightly more reliable flying job, but it will still allow me to carry on with the vintage and aerobatic flying in my spare time, in my days off. So I'm quite looking forward to that.
It was an interesting change. We watched it on social media unfold. I think you were quite open with some of your friends and followers about what was going to happen, and it was not the route originally you'd intended. But I have to say, as some people know, the airline you're going to join, I flew on this year. We flew on them before. We loved them to bits. They entertained my 7-year-old daughter in the cockpit as they were preparing. You know, she was absolutely over the moon. She got to wear the pilot's cap and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, knowing what little I know about you, it's an absolutely brilliant fit. The only thing I did notice is you're not going to be flying from a southern base, though, are you? Is that going to be a problem in terms of the work you're doing with 396?
Well, a lot of the work I do with the Typhoon project is not necessarily physically based at the unit. I tend to go over there sort of 1 day a week. We've got a really great team of volunteers, and that's expanding now. I've actually got four guys coming on board, one of whom has already been helping out a lot over the last year to take on the running of the shop and the membership and the administration and the physical hands-on side of that. So I'm looking to sort of pass that over to them in the short term while I move away up north, as it might be known, up to Doncaster. But that's probably not going to be a long, long-term thing. I'll be up there for a year or two, and I'll be looking then to put a bid in to move back down somewhere to the south, sort of Gatwick, Stansted, where I can be a bit more hands-on again. But it all depends on the roster. You know, Dave Robinson's based up in Staffordshire, so he's nowhere near the unit, but he sort of fairly regularly comes down for the open days and any specific days when we might be meeting guests or potential donors or investors. So, you know, it's all workable. It just means a little bit more travel, a little bit more planning ahead.
Right.
So, well, looking forward to the challenge. So it's certainly going to mean changes. But I'm doing as much as I can to sort of hand over effectively what I've been managing, which is the kind of day-to-day running of the project at the base, to the team of guys that are more than willing, and not only more than willing, but more than capable of running it, because I found out how to do it from scratch in the first instance, made all the mistakes, so now those guys can learn from the mistakes I made, and hopefully we can pass it on, and it'll just continue to grow, which yeah. I have every sort of, you know, every confidence that it will.
And Sam, what's coming up then? Where can people cross paths with you? You mentioned Duxford. Anywhere else they can meet up with you and the team?
So we've got two more shows this season. The Duxford Battle of Britain show on the 22nd and 23rd of September. Then the following weekend on the Saturday, we're at Coningsby for the LLA Open Day, Members Day, I think that is. We then have a Supporters Club Members Open Day at our base in Uckfield, East Sussex, at the end of October. So any members or potential members that might want to join, you will be invited to that open day. Probably a general open day in November, although we're not sure yet. Depends on manpower. But then, you know, our full schedule of what we do is on our website. And it's obviously does change because everyone's doing it in their spare time. So
yeah,
that's the place to see what we're doing, either on our website or on Facebook and Twitter. Put up, you know, everything that we're going to do, everywhere that we're going to be on there.
And just give us a quick reminder of the addresses of that website, will you, Sam?
Sure. The website, dead easy to remember if you're interested in Hawker Typhoons, is hawkertyphoon.com. We got in there early with that one. So, yeah, hawkertyphoon.com, and there are links to all of our social media on there. You know, we're very active on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you Google or search on social media for Hawker Typhoon Restoration, we come up top. So if you search for us, you will definitely find us.
Sam, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule this morning. Good luck with the career change, and hopefully we'll see some more investment coming into to this restoration very soon.
Thanks very much for having us back. I look forward to catching up with you in due course.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Dave, welcome back to Extended.
Hello, Peter. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for taking time out today. Apologies for the quality of the line. We've tracked Dave down on his mobile, but very worthwhile always to speak to Dave Morris, who is, of course, the curator at the Fleet Air Arm Museum. But Dave, today we want to go and revisit the Barracuda restoration. I think we talked maybe a year or two ago last about the actual work that was being done. So what we're looking for is a catch up on the great stuff that Will and the rest of the team are doing in the hangar down at Yeovilton. What's been going on in the last year or so?
Ooh, a lot, even. And people have been very kind of watching it. Fairy Barracuda restoration on Facebook. So there are a number of fairy links on Facebook, but Fairy Barracuda restoration on Facebook at the Fleet Air Arm Museum is the one to tune into. That has the most regular updates. And William and Tony Jupp are very good at sort of almost weekly now posting what they've done mechanically to the aircraft. And a lot of research going on in the background also, but I'm going to just backtrack a second, if I may, and say it's interesting that you've tracked me down this week, and well done. People find it increasingly hard to get hold of me these days. There's so many things going on, so you did well there. But this week of all weeks is very relevant to the Barracuda because it was 74 years ago this week that DP-872 actually had its the tragic crash into Enoch in Northern Ireland, just off of Maydown Airfield. And we've actually put a little mark of respect of that onto the Facebook page. Sub-Lieutenant Oxby, Sub-Lieutenant Dobbin, and Leading Airman Mew, all, of course, perished in the crash. So it's quite appropriate that this week you should pick up, of all weeks, and ask for the update.
Well, sorry, Dave, I wasn't aware of that. So my thoughts go out to the families and friends, of course, of those airmen.
I know, and just looking at it, not that we've got much of an accident report. There's no conclusion to the accident other than the Barracuda was a difficult, heavy beast to fly. But looking at ages 19, 20, and 19, those guys, the responsibilities they had, like any, or not just then, but of course in service now, it just makes you, really drives home the responsibilities and the training requirements put on people at relatively young ages and how they can cope with it and the level of good training, obviously, but sadly things still go wrong, as is evident there.
Very poignant. And of course that was a part of the world where crews were training. My father spent some time out there with fond memories, so those young lads passing will always be remembered. So thanks for bringing that up, Dave.
Indeed. Back to the nuts and bolts of the project. you need to see it to actually start to appreciate it. There's a huge amount that's moved forward, but the Barracuda is such a complicated, bitty, brackety, nut and bolty type aircraft. There are so many individual parts to it that we can spend days, weeks, and months putting together a whole batch of components to put into the build, to go into the jig, which doesn't necessarily always, in photographs or on Facebook or whatever, sure, doesn't look like we've progressed a long way, but trust me, we have. And we're really getting to the stages where, and again, this is always symptomatic of that kind of build. It goes in the jig, then you line up, then something else has to line up, so you've got to take it out of the jig again. Yeah, in, out, in, out. Yeah. We call it the Okie Cokie project sometimes. It used to be in and out of the jig every 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden, stuff stays in the jig, and you're on to the next stage. And that's sort of where we've got to now. So, within a few weeks, hopefully, we're waiting for some more components to come back from plating and finishing to really finalize any decorrosion problems we've got. William's working on some very original pieces of floor section to go in, which we're determined to keep the original, of course, before we cut new metal. Yeah. And that's what's keeping the project a little bit slow, is that determination to use so much original material. But we are turning a corner where the sort of cockpit section, the actual identifiable shape where the pilot would sit, is actually starting to stay in the jig and become defined as quite a visual piece of the Barracuda. So work is definitely moving on in the background, even if it doesn't quite look like it when people tune in.
And I think the point you make...
A lot of people saw it air day. We had it very, very assembled as much as we possibly could on air day when people came to the air show.
Yeah.
And we had a huge amount of people saying, wow, that looks different to last year. So in that sense... we felt that we'd made a stride forward there.
Yeah, and you're not unfamiliar to any restoration, but this one is proving challenging. And the point you make there about nuts and bolts, I think, bless Will and Tony, watching this with their weekly and sometimes daily updates, it simply looks like a bowl of washers here, a bit of stove in there. But that's what it's all about, isn't it? If you want to restore an aircraft to its original condition, you've got to do it through every single nut and bolt.
Yes, and there's different levels of rebuilds and refurbishments and restorations. We are trying to also define what we feel is a museum-level restoration rather than an object which is rebuilt or partly restored to operate or fly or drive or whatever it needs to be. Yes, of course, necessarily you need to change many, many parts for that process doesn't make it any less worthy of a project. Absolutely not. But we're trying to just push the needle a little bit further towards, totally, if we're not going to fly hours, which we're not, we're going to just make sure it's as close to historic accurate, using as much of the original material as possible in our case. So, you know, every object on its own merit, and that's certainly not to lessen the overall outcome of anybody's project.
Yeah,
we're just trying to go very, very historic rather than accept we've got to change stuff to use, you know, and there's the fork in the road, and we can identify that fork, and both are brilliant whichever fork you go down. We're just trying to be very, very museum wise over it.
Yeah. And DP872, that is planned to be displayed at the Fleet Air Arm Museum, is it? Is there any plans to move it around or anything like that once it's restored?
No, she would be too big to sensibly move around. I mean, you know, if people can picture or imagine a Firefly, a Fairy Firefly, which is its closest sort of sister aircraft. So it's 42 feet long. Its tailplane, of course, is, you know, 18 to 20 feet wide. The center section's 18 to 20 feet wide. She stands taller than a Firefly when she's finished. She's the top of the canopy.
Yeah.
Somewhere around 12 foot 6 tall. At least, you know, it's a big airplane. It would be too big to consider transporting to different locations. And yeah, there's enough hall space and opportunity to display it at the Fleet Air Arm Museum. And when we do have the biggest collection of fairy aircraft and fairy archive anywhere in the world, so the natural place for it, alongside the naval link, of course, is the Fairy Aviation Link, which is our, you know, quite a mainstay of our collection.
Yeah, I'll come back to the museum in a minute. I just want to come back one or two final points on the restoration. When we spoke, and it's got to be 2 or 3 years ago now, you talked about the oleos, and when the guys were restoring them, you'd taken the air out, which was original 1940s air, which is just fantastic. Has anything else unearthed itself like that over the last few years? Found any gems?
Nothing quite as intriguing as time captured 1940s air, which, yeah, like we said before, that's been bottled off in clean, flushed out high pressure air containers, and that's gone through Bournemouth University for their environmental school studies, should they wish to. I mean, who knows, they may find a use to compare with 1940s air. So we are always thinking, not necessarily what do we find on the project which is useful to us or interesting to us, but what might be useful or interesting to other people. We are finding some interesting evidence of factory production, I suppose. It would be easy to say that perhaps it's you know, slightly lower standard than you'd expect ordinarily on an aircraft, but it's telling us a very, very interesting story about different production rate during World War II of aircraft with a completely reorganized workforce. You know, you imagine a lot of the workforce in the factory was disrupted and sent away and was now fighting, and then there was a whole raft of new people coming in and picking up lots of new skills. So we're identifying some areas of the build where, just for our eye, we're thinking, that isn't quite to the absolute nth degree aero standard. It looks just a little bit more swiftly put together, or you know, just there's,
wow,
you need to see it. It's difficult to describe it all over the phone, but sometimes if we're making comparisons against what you would do assembling an aircraft with all the time in the world. But of course, we're watching evidence now of an aircraft which was being hurried along the production line. So there's some interesting little insights there, which make just fascinating observation, little snapshot of what it must have been like in a very, very high production factory in wartime conditions. You know, they've got to speed up.
Yeah. And Dave, what's the condition of the engine as well? Are you going to use the engine that came out of the accident aircraft?
We are. DP872's engine is actually overall looking very, very complete and surprisingly good condition. The crash, DP872, went like a dart into a big porridgey peat bog. So the impact was cushioned by that. The engine cowlings sort of wrapped themselves then tight around the engine, and it just plugged straight into this rather porridgey big loop of peat bog.
Yeah.
So the engine itself sustained very little impact damage with the cowlings sort of clasped around them. And visually, externally, she looks very complete. The engine's trashed inside, of course, because the propeller shredded itself and all of the gears and crank and everything was just ripped to shreds inside. But externally, the engine looks actually quite good. We have no intention of running or starting the engine, and that would be hugely costly even just to consider starting a Merlin engine. People say, oh, are you going to start it? Well, yes, but you'd need a blank prop, you'd need a reduction gear, you'd need a pitch control unit, radiators, coolant, all of the ancillaries. You know, you're probably looking at £200,000 or £300,000 just to start an engine. Well, there's no requirement because we wouldn't do it. But to have DP872's actual original engine worked on now externally, visually, to look like her original engine is very important. And, you know, so to keep it for that point of view, we're very fortunate to have it in that condition.
Yeah. And then one final question, Dave, on 872. I don't think I've ever asked this before, but once you're at that stage of wrapping her up and the final bits and pieces, what livery, what colour scheme are you planning to paint her in?
Well, she's got, and that's interesting in itself, because we're picking up remnants of paint from the aircraft, doing our paint archaeology like we've done with Corsair and Martlet, but obviously only now on components. She's in standard temperate scheme of dark sea grey and slate grey with a sky underneath, and we believe, looking at other photographs of aircraft on the squadron at the time, we've still yet to see a photograph of DP-872. That would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But we've got other aircraft in batches very, very close. So we're fairly sure of the overall scheme, just being a standard Royal Navy temperate scheme. And side codes and markings, we're beginning to understand where we think those were on the side. We're way off painting those on yet, of course.
Yeah.
But what we are discovering is some of the mix-matched components through the build, where inside the fuselage, you know, different coloured primers, different coloured interior paint finishes, even different coloured undercarriage legs. But, of course, we do have an accident record where she had a small prang on an airfield about 6 months before her final crash. And it looks like she's been substituted with a different coloured undercarriage leg, looking at the evidence of paint that we've got on the leg and looking at the evidence that we can see in an earlier crash report. So that's how she's going back. We're going to build her as close as we can to the time of the crash, so she will have odd coloured legs. But that's how she was.
Yeah, wonderful.
You know, we're gonna stay true to, you know, the accuracy of the object. Let the object tell us what it was like. So where we can find any gleams of absolute evidence, then that's what we'll use back into the build.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for that, Dave. I can't let you go without talking about the rest of the collection. There's always something interesting going on in the museum. Anything exciting coming up? Have you got anything in the reserve collection you're working on bringing into the museum?
There's always background work going on. Of course, you know, if people are interested, look on the website, because the reserve collection is open typically three times a year, ticketed walk and talk tour with myself around the collection. The next one is the 6th of September, coming up very quickly next week. I believe that's fully subscribed, but check on the website. I don't actually deal with the numbers. I just deal with the talks and tours on the day. So that's always interesting to go and look around, background around the collection. We're always working, hopefully 2 to 3 years ahead, on preparing aircraft and thinking what the next exhibition plans would be and what the next rotation of aircraft from store into the main exhibition halls would be. And actually, that's a process which is ongoing at the moment. So I can't give you any updates, not because I'm keeping some secret jump card up my sleeve. We are literally just beginning to start to discuss that. We're only really formulating that for thinking process at the moment. But there's always background work happening other than the Barracuda. We've got 103 aircraft in total in the collection, so 50 on display, 50 in store. There's a raft of background maintenance and prep and conservation monitoring going on all of the time, which helps us also understand the condition of the collection, but also starts to inform which ones we can bring into display earlier than others, or for whatever reason. Something's occurred to me with the Barracuda. If anybody out there is listening and actually is directly involved, if they were part of the original recovery team or know somebody that was, one or two people are beginning to come forward now and say, yeah, I was on, you know, the recovery party, or I was part of the dive team, or I was part of the Royal Engineers that was building the raft to get out across the peat bog to get to the wreck in 1970. We're really, really keen to hear from anybody that was directly involved with the recovery. And we're thinking of having possibly a bit of a reunion of those people in early November. So if anybody is listening and says, oh, I know so-and-so always said he was involved with that, I'd love to hear from them, and we'd love to get some of the people together.
That's a great point. And as soon as you know those details, Dave, we'll help to promote that event. One final question on the reserve collection, is just a personal one, really. How do you go about maintaining the collection, the reserve collection? Because I would imagine that it's as tricky keeping the airframes in the museum go in and up to scratch. Do you have to continually visit and apply some maintenance to the reserve collection as well?
All the time. I mean, it is a full-time process. Everybody thinks that you know, they don't fly, so there's nothing to do to them. They're just dead static aircraft.
Yeah.
nothing could be further from the truth. Tires, of course, you know, sag and go down all of the time. So with 103 airplanes, if there's a significant change in temperature at a point in the year, and we're actually watching that now, coming up any minute now in September, that there will be a dip change in the temperature, and we will notice that mostly because the whole collection's tires will start to sag or deflate a little bit. That's 2 or 3 days' work straight away, doing 103 aircraft's worth of tires if they need a lot of attention. Undercarriages sag a bit. Brake packs can get sticky. We need to rotate the wheels often to keep the brake units in good nick. Fuel lines, even though there's no fuel in the aircraft, there's residue. There's a teacup full here and an egg cup full there.
Yeah.
And a temperature change might cause a rubber joint to just finally crack and weep a bit, and residues that have been in the pipes for many years can start dribbling out. We've got to be mindful of that. It can take several days then to locate exactly where the leak is, because it isn't necessarily where it's dripping out. There's a huge amount of work going on. We always laugh and say, you know, we should stick a sign up in the hangar which says, you know, people come in and think we do nothing. We always say, if you've got nothing to do, please don't do it here.
and Dave, is that specialist work, or do you look for volunteers to help with that?
A mix of both. Yeah, there are tasks. I have got some volunteers, two or three good volunteers that can do, certainly competent to do work up to a level, and you know, whether that's, you know, a craft level, or whether that's a safety level, or something we could sensibly ask volunteers to have input into. And then there's the work levels, which are deeper and more technical, or you know, more complicated beyond that. So hopefully we're fairly effective at identifying that and spreading it out amongst the team, but there's a lot of ground to cover, you know.
Yeah. Dave, one final question then, coming back to the Barracuda restoration. It's a question I always ask, but what's the plan for completion, or is how long is a piece of string?
A little bit, yeah. People say, how long is it going to be? And I say 42 feet.
Very good, very good.
Doesn't quite answer that question. I don't know. At the moment, it's still too early to predict an end time. When people come into the hangar and actually see the work in progress and start looking at the material we've got to work with, and the fact that so much of it is being re-straightened out and incorporated, how long does an undercarriage leg take apart? We have no idea whether it's going to come apart in 2 days, 10 days, or 40 days. You know, some of this stuff is so stuck and corroded and bent or out of shape, it can take days and days and days just to take one component off to be able to save that one original component. So We got volunteers working on that whilst we're doing other work, and you know, we've got a good blend of how that feeds around the team, but trying to predict how long a certain component is going to take to unfree itself and unstick itself and unjam itself, that's just always a guess. So at the moment, we're still too early in the stages of undoing so much of the wreckage to be able to predict that. But it is speeding up. That sounds slightly negative in some ways, but it's not, because the team is getting on top of procedures and our own experiments and our own sort of knowledge of how stuff can get apart now all the time. And, you know, we're learning all the time. We're upping our game all the time. And, yeah, tune in and anywhere where you can see the visuals, or come to the museum, of course, and see it through the glazed viewing panel windows in the workshop. And there is a significant stage change in what the Barracuda now looks like.
Wonderful. Dave, well, I'm looking forward to coming along and seeing it. And as Dave said there, this is a real live restoration project. If you go to the museum, which is always worth it, there's always something great to see there. You can go along and you can see, bless Will and Tony, hard at work restoring the aircraft. So do go down and see a restoration in progress. Dave, as always, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us on your Sunday morning.
Pleasure, Peter, and of course you know you're welcome anytime. Absolutely.
I feel like I've got a rubber band attached to me for that place. I'll be back soon. Dave, thanks very much.
Look forward to it. Thank you all.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is of course Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, that's it. That's a wrap on our restoration project updates. Thank you to White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their help in producing the show. You can find me, Peter Johnson, on Twitter at Nascot Hornet. You can find Gareth at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and Tim Robinson at RAESTimR on Twitter. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
the cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
This is XTP Media.